The Eclogue for Piano and Strings by Gerald Finzi. The premiere was given in January 1957 at a memorial concert of Finzi's works. You heard Howard Shelley and the City of London Sinfonia, conducted by Richard Hickox. I'm Melissa Owsley. Thanks for your company.
You are listening to 89.3, the station making waves at whfr.fm.
This is the station making waves. My name is Dennis Reimers, and it's time for the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for, I'd say, Dearborn and the surrounding communities. And sometimes we touch a little bit further out than that, and sometimes we are really super duper close to home. Like, we're going to start the show this way. We're going to start with something very, very, very local. Let me pad down here a little bit, make sure we get all our levels right. As our regular listeners know, we do all this on the air, on the fly. It's the best way to learn. And guess what? I'm still learning. All right, we're going to check our microphones in studio. I'll pull this down. And as I have been the last few shows, I'm joined in studio by John Conroy. John, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here, Dennis. Thanks.
All right, we got this going here. And we talked about this last week. We talked extensively about the subject of Snow White. but now we actually have the director and writer. I mean, you revised this, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. But Judy Fletcher, just somebody that's so dear to myself and my family, and it was so good to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Let's get this right.
I'm so glad to be here. I really am.
Well, you have, this is no small feat here. Okay, I'm having a little bit of difficulty. Could be my headphones. How do I sound to you guys? Okay?
Sound good.
Sound fine.
Oh, you're just saying that because it's true. All right, there we go. I'm a little bit more comfortable with that. Judy, I'm not going to say the year, but I had to be no more than 8 or 9 years old. I watched The Wizard of Oz on TV, mm-hmm. the musical, and I was so, I don't know what you want to call it, overwhelmed by it. You know, it really, really influenced me. I was so influenced okay. that I immediately, that evening, set out to rewrite it. It was so good that I felt the need. No, to kind of summarize it a little bit, to make it something that was more palatable for somebody my age who was performing in a mm-hmm. like a speech or a theater class in elementary school. We actually had that on like 3 days a week. It was pretty cool. And I actually rewrote this thing. So it was like 3 pages long, handwritten. So it was what, maybe 5 minutes, you know? Mm-hmm. But I felt compelled to do that. You didn't, that's not what you did. But in a sense, you did your own version of Snow White. Did you not?
Yes. I did the research and saw every film that's come out lately. I mean, it's been a really big topic in the last couple of years. We have, you know, Snow White and the Huntsman, and we have Once Upon a Time on television. And there's many versions that have been portrayed, both in film, on TV. And there's also theater versions. I was looking at different scripts, and nothing... Some of them were a lot older, and the language was older, and I didn't know how appealing it would be to today's children.
Especially, that's a good point, because you have the matinees during the week, or you did this past week. What was the average age of those kids?
Well, anywhere from kindergarten up through probably fifth, sixth grade.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, you're looking at somebody, the attention span, like any children, is very short, so you had to work with that, too.
1 hour long.
Yeah. Well, I remember, and Chris Bremer did a fantastic job. I don't think... Did he rewrite it for...
No.
Okay, no, he went pretty standard.
He went with a written script already.
Sleeping Beauty.
It was a very short version. It was less than 45 minutes.
Yeah, I remember he did a wonderful job.
It was a lot of
and
fun.
They had rotating cast and everything, but mm-hmm. for what you're doing, I want to take a step back because this is not your first trip to the rodeo. Well, there we go. You and I like you had mentioned off the air, my wife and I took an acting class with you. I don't think I've ever had more fun than that. Just so you know, John, my wife and I did basically everything together. I mean, Judy said by the end of it, she's like, okay, that's enough. You guys, you have an unfair advantage. You can go home and work on this together, and other people may not have that. So she made us draw names from a hat. And Joe Webster, I don't know if you remember that, Judy, mm-hmm. just this great kid. And we did The Odd Couple, a scene from The Odd Couple, a very famous scene. Are you laughing, Judy?
Yes, it was priceless.
Well, Judy's mandate was, she goes, that's fine, Dennis, but, you know, you're kind of a sports fanatic, and you're probably a little bit sloppy or unkempt. And you're,
I didn't see that.
Well, no, I'm ad-libbing now. Anyway, she thought that I would be much more appropriate if I was cast as, not Felix, but Oscar Madison. So, of course, her mandate was that I be Felix.
Okay. Of course.
All right. We had...
Look at the challenge.
Oh, my gosh. We had so much fun. I wore an apron, and I got up on stage with a vacuum cleaner. Oh, my God. I've never had more fun than that. Even when I'm writing, and that's my passion. So, but then I wasn't able to be here for the semester that you were the director of Grease, and I know that was something that was just a huge thing in your mind, you know, to you and your career. But you had my wife.
Yes, I did.
Jennifer was the assistant director.
Yes, she was. What oh, my God. She was... She was right there. She had my back.
Between
all the time.
You and Don, between her and Don, I think they did. Don right. was the stage manager. What a little bit more about your background, though, because I know you've done a lot of different things, and you actually went to Greece.
Yes, I did.
As a performer.
Yes. Well, I did community theater when I was a lot younger, and high school theater and that kind of thing. But then there were many years I was married. I tried to do community theater, but time constraint was really tough. But later on, when my kids were older, I had the opportunity to go to Greece to perform with the U of D Mercy Theater group that was doing an annual trip. Mary Bremer, who is also on faculty here,
yep.
she and her husband, Dr. Arthur Beer, who runs the program at U of D, did an annual trip to Greece, staying on a Greek island, a little island, very remote island, and putting together an actual Greek play styled for contemporary audiences.
But it wasn't it performed at one of the outdoor amphitheaters?
Yes, we performed all over. We toured with that to three other places, and then finally ended in Athens.
Now, what was the one that I saw? Because Chris Bremer, Mary right, Bremer Beer's son,
was also on faculty. Her son,
and at the time he was just starting an act. He may have actually been during his banking career, because he had a career in mm-hmm. working in the banks for a short time before he said, "No, I'm not doing this." And boy, he was funny in that. But the play that the tragedy you did was where the women were trying to get the men not to go to war. That was the one I saw.
Well, that's Lysistrata.
Okay.
Or other people call it Lysistrata.
Okay.
But, yeah, Lysistrata, yes. That's a classic
so
play.
Funny.
It's a comedy, okay. right? We did a comedy called, there were two Greek names, I can't remember. It was about, similar topic, mm-hmm. women going on a sex strike to
right. See,
to
you call it a comedy. I think that's a tragedy. But whatever.
It's a comedy.
I digress.
it was funny, and it was a musical. We had a music director that traveled with us and wrote the songs.
So watching the video was hilarious.
Oh yeah.
And it was supposed to be. It wasn't hilarious right. because it wasn't done right. It was hilarious because it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And some of the other things, because I'm always curious where you, because I know you performed a lot, mm-hmm. and I want to say you sang a lot, too, mm-hmm. music. At what point did you look at directing and say, because you're very good at it, so I'm assuming you knew that at some point that was going to be in that direction.
Well, I guess I shouldn't say every actor, but a lot of actors, because I hear film actors talking about it, that, you know, their dream is to actually be behind the camera or behind, you know, in the audience, directing from the
audience.
Judy,
the grass is always greener. We know that.
Well, probably a control thing. I don't know.
Yeah. In my case, it definitely would have been. Sure.
But I was offered the opportunity here to direct quite a while ago one show. I had taken directing classes uh-huh. in college and had done some shows there at Wayne State. Small shows in the Hillbury Theater, the studio theater.
Right.
And I had a good background in directing, but I really wanted to be I really wanted to act. And I did that for a long time. And then teaching here and then being offered the opportunity to direct, get my feet wet, do a small show. And I did that. And then it grew from there. I've done a couple shows now since then.
What was the one you did two summers ago, I want to say? It could have been three. Gosh, time flies. It was a series of monologues.
I performed in that.
Oh, that was for Mary Bremer Beer,
right,
was it
that
not?
Was, okay. That was Vital Signs.
So much fun.
Yeah, and then I performed this summer, too.
Did you?
Yes, she did another show called Drinking in America.
I remember reading all
right.
about it. Yep.
Yeah, I was in that, and I sang in that, too.
How
yeah,
neat.
She puts me in the, makes me sing, which is fine.
One of the things that I've noticed, and being a teacher, your job, obviously, is a transitional one. You're there here to oversee, guide these mm-hmm. kids. These are kids in a lot of cases. My wife and I think we're the exception. Most of these kids are a little bit younger.
I have a few.
Okay.
We have a few older students, too.
But the bottom line, hold on. The bottom line is that your job is to oversee them, and then you have to let them go.
Right, right.
How hard is that?
We kick them out of the nest.
Yeah?
And send them on. It's
well, it's easier for Jerry. I know that Jerry Jablinski, he's the technical director, I believe,
right.
Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. It's bittersweet to see them leave, especially when you get close. Theater draws people into kind of a family.
Oh, yeah.
And you perform, when they're here for 2 years, we have a new crop, you might say,
right.
coming in. And we, others graduated this past May. And, our students have gone to Wayne, on to Oakland University.
Scotland.
And to Scotland.
Tim Pollack is
yes.
in Scotland. I'm so proud of him.
Yes, he is performing, or he's going to school over there. So, we are very gratified. That's our goal, is to send them on to a university program.
Right.
Yes, it's difficult, especially when they've grown so much in their craft and they've performed wonderfully on stage here, and then we lose them and
right.
we start all over again. And, I have a really good group that's performing in Snow White. Two-thirds of them probably have never been on stage.
I look through, as you do with every production, In the fine arts building, you'll have right in the middle there kind of a history of maybe some of the things that are relevant to the play or the production you're putting
mm-hmm.
on. And then you'll have photos. I love your photo, by the way. You're kind of looking up off to the right. That's awesome. It's a great photo.
Thanks.
And then I don't know if there's just names or bio.
We didn't put the bios up
okay.
this time. The bios are in the program.
I noticed mm-hmm. Dania.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Greece.
Right.
And then there was one other person that I recognized and nobody else.
Right.
And that I know that that's part of it. If I mm-hmm. recognize too many more people, I mean, you're probably not doing as good of a job, or they're not
right.
reaping what they're reaping what they sow. So you're right. I hate goodbyes. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And they keep in touch for a while.
Yeah.
The apron strings, hanging on to the program, they come back and visit. And then it gets less and less,
yeah.
and,
They grow up. They're going to have families.
Right.
They're going to do those things.
Right.
And for me, I think, first of all, I scared the heck out of you when I just popped into costuming. But then you realized it was me, and I was so happy to see you.
Yeah,
it had
so
been
happy
a while.
To see you. Right.
We're with Judy Fletcher. This is the new WHFR Journal. Judy's production, written and directed by her. And that, to me, is so powerful. It's a familiar name, Snow White. There will be differences, twists?
Yeah. Snow White and the Dwarves.
Okay.
Because we have 9 of them.
Okay.
And they're not little people.
Okay.
They're students. One of them, Tiny, the dwarf, is 6'4" and about 300 pounds.
Irony.
Yeah.
That's
and,
so funny.
He
fell down the stairs and he broke his arm and his wife left him. What do you call him? Lucky. Okay. Anyway.
No, I didn't do Lucky the dwarf. We considered, I had my... with my family bouncing things off of them, and we considered many different names for these dwarves.
I'm sure.
But I finally settled on Cranky instead of Grumpy,
right?
Dizzy instead of Dopey.
Like it.
Let's see, in Drowsy instead of Sleepy, and Sappy and Silly, and Snotty instead of Sneezy.
What about Doc?
Tiny's pretty much Doc.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, he's pretty much the he brings everybody together, and he's the
voice
kind
of
the leader,
yeah.
And yet Cranky's kind of the leader too. Cranky does his thing, but
I have to see this thing.
They sometimes go off the script a little bit. Cranky woke up from one of the spells, and he said, I have to get to anger management. I almost died and fell out of my seat tonight.
Because that wasn't in the script?
No, that wasn't.
This is I'm looking at the wrong one. The right one. What information can you give me? Because I actually picked up the pottery information.
Oh.
It's showing tomorrow during the day, and then tomorrow night, and then Sunday.
Correct. Yes, we have the 7 o'clock performance this evening.
Okay.
We have two performances tomorrow at 2 and 7, and then Sunday at 2. Okay. And that's our final performance.
And then and ticket prices are, $15?
I think it's $15 for adults, $12 for students, faculty, staff, and seniors.
Awesome.
And then $10 for children. But if you bring a group of 10 or more in, I think the tickets are
$8. $8, yep, I saw that. And I thought that was just, and people, seriously, if, you know, we got big groups to get people together to come see this. And then when Jen and I were performing, or in her case, she was directing one, we called everybody we knew and told them, look, $8 a piece. Really, for what you're getting, right, you can't beat that.
Right. It's, you know, it does cost money to do these shows, which people like, you know, they think it doesn't, but it does.
No, you know, that's never clearer than when you take the one-act play production in the, I think it's usually in the spring term,
right,
where you, right out of the gate, Jerry sits you down and says, okay, if we do this, this is what it costs. And he right. factors everything. Mm-hmm. And it becomes real, very real.
Right. There is a budget that you have to adhere to, and unfortunately.
From what I understand, if that's your role in the play, that's one of the jobs of a producer, is it not? Not in our school, but like in a producer, isn't he or she in charge of money?
Right. The producer does control the purse strings and hires, you know, the technical people and the artistic staff, the designers. I mean, you have to consider all of that.
Sure.
We, you know, that's one thing you probably remember from acting class. Theater is a collaborative effort.
Absolutely.
And we all have to work together.
Yeah.
Actors, you know, a lot of these kids that come out of high school, you know, they're all consumed with being famous and being, you know, on stage and
right.
being an actor. But I try to
ground them.
ground them into the fact that, you know, we have to depend on everyone else. We have lighting people to make you look good, makeup people, costumers, the sound effects, all these things that enhance a performance.
Exactly.
And they require very specialized training to do this. We all work together to bring our talents.
Well, what I thought was interesting with the one-act plays anyway, because I actually was on stage and I had an opportunity to be my wife's, assistant director, whatever you want to call it. There's a name that
stage
I call.
Stage manager?
Yeah, but there's a name that she called me that I don't want to get into. But anyway, it's my wife. She can. But John, there were things that when this was going on, this particular act, let's say, lowering a light from the top that's hidden throughout every performance except for the 5 minutes of this particular scene, and you have to be there, and it's a timing thing, and it doesn't sound that hard, but when this is one of five or six tasks in addition to helping your wife and being in it's a crazy experience. But man, talk about a learning experience. And none of this happens without everybody doing what they want. And believe me, when you didn't do your job, everybody knew.
Well, it's a domino effect. Things can go dreadfully wrong.
Absolutely.
If you don't actually have it timed very precisely, and everybody watching and being focused and paying attention.
Didn't the lights go off in the beginning of Grease?
Well, there was some kind of a technical difficulty with the lights. And
right.
The power, that's what it was. The electricity completely went out in the theater.
While the performance is going on.
We just started.
Yeah.
Just at the top of the show, and Danny and Sandy are going to be singing out there, and all of a sudden everything went out, and it also affected Kevin in the booth. Kevin Dooley, our music director, he was up in the orchestra, and his power all went out. His monitors, mics, everything was gone, and he ran out in the hall. He ran down to his office and dragged his piano down the hall.
That's right.
And they just kept singing. They kept singing perfectly. He brings the piano
in the dark.
In the dark. Yeah. And they're all in the dark. They're singing. They kept singing. And he wheeled the piano in, opened the door, and started playing the piano. They heard the music. Everybody stayed right on pitch, right in sync. And then the lights magically came up, and they finished the song just right perfectly.
No,
I was so proud of them.
This was the first performance of all of them.
Yep.
And I was driving in. Do you remember from Ludington? I had taken a radio job, and I was driving in from Ludington three and a half hours, and I got there right after the lights came on. So I come in, this sounds great. Everything's great, right? And everybody's looking at me like, you son of a gun.
You have no idea what we just went through.
Yeah, and my wife was like, she lost like 4 pounds from sweating. It was incredible. But that is the life of real live theater, isn't it?
It's very immediate, yes, and things do go wrong. I mean, we try to do everything to prevent with planning. Nothing's going to go wrong, but they still go wrong. And these are still people. They're humans. The kids were so excited today. They said, are these going to be real people on stage? And I'm like, yes, these
are
real
people. You mean the kids
in
the audience?
Yes, the little kids coming in.
Sure.
We had 385 today.
Wow.
And they were all excited. We're greeting them at the door and seating them and, like, cattle calls, moving them along, and because they're just, you know, looking at everything,
yeah. And taking it all in.
They're all excited, and and they were surprised, and it was interesting because they're only familiar with television or film.
Sure.
And very, very few of them have ever seen anything live.
That's so cool.
So that's why I do it, because to expose kids to live theater, live anything, live musical performances.
Right, right.
People really do this. They're live people.
We have a great story we're going to talk about later that they're actually bringing, you know, with cost cuts in the school districts, that some of the first things to go are things like music.
Yes.
Sports to a degree, but I know that pay to play is a little more affordable to maybe an athlete. I don't know. I shouldn't say more affordable, but it just seems like sometimes that gets a priority over the drama and, mm-hmm. and music. But anyway, they're bringing it back to all the Dearborn schools.
Well,
and I just think
fabulous.
That is so, yeah, because, I mean, the two biggest influences in my life were music and sports, and I think to have both of them, the teamwork, and there's teamwork in music as well.
Right. I always say that I think theater is one of the best team sports there is.
Absolutely.
Because everybody has got to learn to get together, get along, listen to each other, and respect one another.
And, you know, and when you do make a mistake, and I don't mean whether it's accidental or if you're just being obnoxious, your peers are the ones there. Your teacher has
right.
some say, your grade or whatever, but your peers, that's a little bit of a harder thing to deal with.
Right.
So that's where that cooperation right. comes in. Judy, thanks for spending your time with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Folks, again, it's 7 o'clock tonight at the Adria Auditorium, which is in the probably the westernmost building on our campus in the southwest corner. You can park right there, take the south parking lot to the back. At 7 o'clock tonight, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. tomorrow, and then 2 p.m. again. The final performance will be on Sunday. Ticket price are $4. Get 9 of your closest friends and family, and you'll
kids,
have it.
Little kids.
Yeah,
kids
the kids
love
will,
it.
Everybody will love this, too. It sounds like for all ages. Judy Fletcher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis.
We are going to take a short non-commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to talk local news. Please stay tuned.
Justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Are you looking for help along your path in life? Perhaps you feel in need of guidance, yet everywhere you turn there seems to be no satisfactory answers? In that case, maybe something from the world of metaphysics might be the solution. Open up to new possibilities in your quest for happiness by listening to Metaphysically Speaking every third Tuesday of the month from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
You are round MVP.
Yeah, man. Yo, Drew, I finally got round MVP. Round MVP.
No way. That was some ownage. It's a good thing you got me as your wingman.
Right. You mean when you threw that flash grenade at me?
Whatever, man. Huge round. Seriously, great stuff.
Finally earning round MVP takes determination. So will getting into college. I've got what it takes.
All right, class. I'm going to pass back your tests. And a high score goes to Brian.
Oh, yeah, high score, baby.
Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org.
I've got what it takes. So do you.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ag Council.
For more information in Michigan, visit knowhowtogomichigan.org. That's knowhowtogomichigan.org.
We are back, and it is the new WHFR Journal. Here we are on, I never even said the date. It is, oh boy, Friday, November 22nd, 2013. We're coming up on about 1:25 in the afternoon. In case you're podcasting at a future day or time, that was Judy Fletcher. She just left, and we have just an awesome second half of the show coming up. I'm really looking forward to it. John is letting Judy out. He will be in shortly. And we are joined, actually, he's here right now. I'll introduce him officially in a little bit. We're joined in studio by Dearborn Times Herald staff writer Bob Oliver. And Bob covers a lot of the areas that I used to cover. I was with a different paper, but I have to say he does a better job than I did. Maybe that's why he's doing it and I'm not. And anyway, we'll get this music down. Bob, there's your microphone. We're going to do a sound check. He just basically came right in the studio when Judy was leaving. So we're going to, you don't even have to lean in. Just kind of get comfortable. How are you with that?
Hello, Dennis.
All right, that's perfect. Yeah, we checked the mics early. This is independent, non-commercial radio, so we'll do a lot of things on the fly. Let me turn this off here. I want to thank you so much for joining me, joining us. John will be here in just a second. This is kind of, when I say a cool time, I don't mean it. They may come out as wrong when we start talking about some of the stories, but it really is a very interesting, dynamic time to be a journalist right now in this area, is it not?
No, there's a lot going on right now. I mean, the election season always has a lot that it adds to the news, but just outside of that, there's been a lot of very interesting stories that have just occurred, say, in the last 2-3 months.
Yeah.
That it really...
Heck, in the last 2-3 weeks.
2-3 weeks, yeah.
And I want to go, and I know from your writing, I wasn't kidding, you handle this stuff, you cover this stuff really well, really well. And I know what it takes, because you're doing a lot of stories. You're taxed with a lot of responsibilities. And in fact, I told people we wanted to get you in last week, but I mean, you went right from the announcement. Were you downtown?
Yep. I drove all the way to the Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, and I was there for the announcement from Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy when she announced the 3 charges.
Okay. We'll get into that whole topic in just a second, because I think that as much as we don't like to talk about certain things on this show, I mean, it's not that we're putting a positive spin on anything, but I will say right now, before I forget, the opinions expressed here on the new WHFR Journal are not necessarily those of anyone here at the college. They may be just the three of us in this room, and we may disagree, but we're very grateful to the college for giving us this opportunity to speak about these things. You went from downtown, and the gentleman was actually arraigned.
Yep.
Here in Dearborn, and so and in the timing, you just couldn't be here, and I appreciated the phone calls and everything.
Right, yeah, it was a weird timing. Friday is our deadline day.
Yeah.
We lay out the paper, so I went to Detroit in the morning. And then when I came back to town, I had to hurry up and file. And then they announced that they were going to arraign the suspect at, I believe it was 2 p.m.
Yeah.
In the 20th District Court, which is inside the Dearborn Heights Police Station.
Right over here. But unfortunately, you know, I would have loved to have given you a microphone and have you do something live, but that's not realistic. So let's talk about this. You've covered it literally from the beginning. Can you in a nutshell kind of summarize what happened, what we know as the facts right now? Thank you.
That's a good way to.
Because I want people to know we're not policemen, we're not attorneys, and we're not judging or doing anything like that. In your case, you're reporting very, very neutrally exactly what happened, the facts, and what we're doing is kind of, not for lack of a better word, we're analyzing them a little bit, maybe talking about the ramifications. So
yeah.
If you could summarize what happened with Ms. McBride.
Okay, she was. The 911 call came in from the homeowner at 4:42 a.m., and it's the 16,000 block of West Outer Drive, which is only a few blocks from Warren, which is the divider between Detroit and Dearborn Heights.
So a few blocks from the Detroit side of Warren.
Right.
Okay.
And that's important because the evidence is showing the police that she was involved in a single car accident in Detroit, at just before 1 a.m. is when the 911 call came in to report the car accident.
Okay.
So the police aren't saying what happened in between there. That's hearsay.
Okay.
But what happened is she was in an accident, and then she somehow made her way to the house on Outer Drive, and she was, it looks like, shot through the front screen door. The storm door was open, but the screen door was locked. When police arrived, it was still locked.
Okay.
And then they were called to the scene from there.
Okay.
So that's...
And the suspect, he's claimed that he felt that he was in danger, and that the gun went off. It was an accident, is what I read.
That was an earlier report that I had read, too. The Dearborn Heights released a redacted version of their report.
Okay.
And a lot of parts are redacted out of it.
Okay.
And it doesn't say what his actual testimony is. I have not heard that from the sergeants or the detectives, that they have said that he was that he has claimed an accidental shooting. But that was reported early on, yes.
Okay.
That, he felt he was in danger. It was... If the shooting happened just before the 911 call, then we're putting this at 4:35, 4:40 in the morning. It was rainy. He was asleep.
Right. Okay. I got you. I heard, you know, I work for the city of Dearborn Heights, and there's rumors fly all over the place, and I don't even know where this one came from, but I had heard that initially, I don't know if you'd heard this, Dearborn Heights police did want to charge him, and Kim Worthy's the one who said, hold on, let's make sure we have all the facts. Did you hear that as well?
Oh, that is very true. Okay. We are on a mailing list for the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, and what happened was the Dearborn Heights Police Department investigated the incident, sent their findings and a warrant request. They didn't say what the warrant was for,
right,
but they sent the findings to the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. They, in return, sent it right back that day and said, we would like you to do some more investigating.
Okay.
Again, they didn't say what they wanted investigated, but they didn't think that they were ready yet. So the Dearborn Heights Police took the information back, maybe 6 days later returned it, then the following day the charges were filed.
And I was out of town at the time. I came back right at the time that they were coming back with their findings. And then, of course, you and I talked, and you said, well, it depends on how this thing goes.
Right.
You would be available if a decision had made one way. But the way it played out was it took all of your time.
Yeah. They literally sent the notice to us about the press conference from Kim Worthy.
Right.
Thursday afternoon.
Okay.
So it's up until then, like, yeah, if they're not going to make a decision, then we're going to be, you know, we're going to be good to go. But no, they made it immediately, and they had the press conference, the arraignment, and now we're at a point where we have a preliminary examination for the suspect on, I believe it's December 18th.
Okay.
In the 20th District Court.
Boy, yeah, it's going to affect his Christmas. I'm not making light. That's not funny. But I am saying what I did hear from somebody, another source within the community, or not within the community, but within the city of Dearborn Heights, said that if somebody made him make a choice, he says it doesn't look good. Now, again, I'm no way related to the law, but I thought it was really interesting that he was so, and he does have a background to a degree in this, and he said, just the way things look right now, this guy is going to go to jail. And I was like, wow, I mean, it just seems like this will play out. So this could go on for a long time, you know, and how can you get in the head of either of them at the time? You know what I mean? She had an alcohol level of almost three times the legal rate. I mean, there are a lot of things that, like you said, the weather, it was dark, it was sleepy, it was, you know, a lot of things went into this. So for them to come back and it seemed like they had at least a decent amount of evidence to be able to make that. You know, nobody wants to waste people's money or time, is what I'm saying.
And when the pretrial comes out, some of these questions should be answered in terms of, did she go to other houses before she went to his house? Was she in the neighborhood a long time walking around? There are several questions that, as a journalist, you have, you know, you want to know, but you understand the investigation is going on and they're not going to release this information.
Oh, absolutely. Right. John?
Yes, Bob. The question I had was related to what you were just talking about. Did Miss McBride know anyone in that neighborhood, or was she known by folks in that neighborhood to want to go in there to see if somebody that she knew would let her in?
Yeah, the knowing anybody in the neighborhood has not been addressed. They have announced that they are quite sure that she did not know the homeowner.
Okay.
So it doesn't appear that she went to that house, that she knew the homeowner, and she was, you know, it seems that she was going because her cell phone was dead. She was looking to call 911.
Okay.
And she was just looking for help.
Okay. That's how it looked. And again, at that alcohol level, you may wander in areas that you're not even aware of.
Don't.
You know, I don't know, whatever. The effects of alcohol are, I mean, some usually unpredictable, but I think at that high of a level, I can say that she was at least disoriented, you know?
Well, and especially she was also only 19, and she wasn't a large person.
Right.
So with an alcohol content that large in a body that small, yeah, it's really going to... affect your thinking.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's unfortunate. What a tragedy. And like I said, we don't know the law, and I didn't mean to be irresponsible and say that somebody told me that this guy's going to jail for a long time. He's in the know, and he has more information than I do, but still probably not all of it. So that is not a statement that this guy is guilty or anything like that. We'll see how this plays out. And this isn't a story. So, you know, Bob, I don't know if you've listened to the show at all, but we don't normally cover things like this because it's, you know, we're more in tune with like the political things and things that affect the people, the community. But this definitely got a national spotlight. Had I not been driving, because I was, we were driving back from San Diego, literally 8 to 12 hours a day. I didn't have my laptop on at all. I had no idea, but apparently this was the people were talking about this on a national level.
When I went to Kim Worthy's office, I talked to some of the other reporters there, and I mean, Time Magazine, New York Times,
yeah,
the heavies were there. I mean, it's gotten a lot of national exposure.
And the little bit of national exposure I saw was they're comparing this to the Trayvon Martin case, which I'm not sure that's a fair comparison, but I don't know. It will all come out. You have done quite a few other really great articles. Hold on. This is one, and this came out last week, maybe 5 days ago, so you probably wrote it a week ago, and it's about the Dearborn Public School Board discusses student body and overcrowding. Were you at the meeting? Did you get a chance to go?
Yep.
Okay. Was that that would have been around the same time? Oh, actually, no. You wrote an article about Whiston getting, being named Superintendent of the year. Okay, that was at a prior meeting, though, wasn't it?
Nope, they both were announced at the same meeting. They let us know that before the meeting, the journalist, that Mr. Whiston had won the award, but they didn't want anybody to say anything.
So he didn't know?
He knew he was nominated, but okay. He didn't know that he had won. So representatives from the Wayne County schools and somebody from the the School Administrators Association of America, they had came to the meeting, and they were being hidden in an office about a half hour into the meeting. Then they were brought out of a back door and came to the front and completely caught him off guard.
Half an hour, and there better have been some really good food in there. You know, I'm glad it caught him off guard. Now, have you had an opportunity to speak to him at all on a personal? What a nice guy.
Well, the telling sign, and it's you feel bad for him because he blushes really easy, and he's really shy. So as soon as they came out and he recognized what was going on, he got beet red and tried burying his face in his hand. And
well, it's funny because we had Dave Mustin in, who does a lot of public relations, and he's like the spokesperson, I guess you'd say, for the city, for the school board. Thank you. The school board. And so we've had him on a couple times, and he was actually a student of Jay Cornick. Jay is actually the founder. I don't know if you've ever met him. He's actually the founder of the new WHFR Journal, this show. And you could argue of the actual radio station, because he started it as a club and it turned into a radio station in 1985. And Jay was the catalyst behind that. But Dave Mustin was a student of Jay's. So they knew each other, and I'd call, and you know, as the producer of the show, I'd call to schedule things, and we got Dave, and who I love, and he was great. But when they were gearing up for this latest the bond issue, they were out the big guns, and Mr. Whiston came in, and what a great guy, very quick-witted.
Yeah,
I was a little bit surprised how funny he was, you know. And of course, as you reported in your article, the bond issue passed, as did just about everything else.
Everything passed. The library millage passed. That's for 0.95 mils.
But that's for Dearborn Heights, correct?
For Dearborn Heights.
And Mike McCaffrey was just praying for that. Yeah.
Yeah. He was out a lot speaking on that, and wow. I believe he did a good job. He got it passed.
And we had him on one of the shows here. It may have been, was it New WHFR Journal?
Not ours. I don't believe he was with ours.
There may have been. I do another show for Dearborn Heights once in a while, and he may have been on there, but just an eloquent speaker. And like you said, I mean, this was needed, and he got out there and just told everybody that would listen the importance of this. You covered the election really well, and I know that Jay was actually in for a election recap with John the Friday after that election Tuesday. Were you surprised by anything? Because I have to tell you, I followed it from my trip from San Diego when I could get a chance, and I saw the winners. For me, when I saw Susan DeBaja's name, didn't surprise me that she won. She seemed very qualified, but she beat out everybody. Did that surprise you at all?
That surprised me a lot. No. As the districts were being added to the website, it's a slow process.
Sure.
Their cards get added in, so you've got, you know, 10 districts have reported, or precincts, I'm sorry, and then you've got 20 precincts, and then you've got 30, and there are 56 precincts in Dearborn, I believe, and they had 55 in, and it was a dead even tie.
Dead even.
Between current council president Thomas Tefelsky and Susan DeBaja, who has never even run for the city council before.
No.
That in itself is a surprise to get that many votes. And it's really, it's not a presidential election year, so it's harder to get people to come to the polls.
Absolutely.
But to get that much support first time out of the gate was amazing. And that she won, yes.
Can you talk about what happened with that final precinct?
Yep, yeah.
Because you told me, and I thought that was a fascinating story.
Yeah, what happened was the memory card or the flash drive that had the results was actually forgotten and locked inside. It was Miller Elementary School.
That was the last precinct.
It was the last precinct. And they were, you know, trying to find the card, and they realized that it was still in the building, but the building was locked.
Wow.
So they got a hold of Mr. Whiston, the superintendent, and the chief of police, Mr. Haddad from Dearborn. And
Chief Haddad, he's great. Yeah.
They were able to get the card and get it over to the city clerk inside City Hall to get it uploaded to get the final result.
And she did very well in that precinct. So yeah, that put her over. But you said the way you averted it to me the first time was like they had a police escort. Well, they did.
Yep.
It all had to be completely. I mean, there can't be any. What's the word that they use for a chain of whatever evidence? They had to be able to verify that it was accurate, right?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So that's cool. Well, tell me about the student body and the overcrowding.
That was an issue that was not on the agenda, but it was brought up by one of the members of the Board of Trustees, and she had, or the Board of Education, and she had asked about it. They had made a report. They've actually, when I spoke to Dave Mustin, he said they have done several reports to establish just what the ideal capacity is at all of their school buildings in the Dearborn Public Schools and what the maximum capacity is. And the worry is that retention, if students get held back a grade, if they don't make the needed adjustments to make it from 9th to 10th grade, 10th to 11th grade, they get held back, and then the next group is coming right up under them, and the school board has realized that this is 26 straight years that the student body has grown.
Right.
So some of those students are going to go into 9th and 10th grades. So you've already got a large student body that's getting more students annually just because people move into the area.
Sure.
And then now
that the
economy
is getting better, that is a fact now, where this is growing again like it used. Maybe not to the same level. So what were they looking at in the future? 3 or 4 years? Or I mean, were they saying, because I remember hearing at some point, they're like, I think it was 4 years from now, we're not going to have any room.
Right.
And you're too young to remember this, but maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I remember they used to have like trailers alongside Fordson High School, temporary classrooms, because they had so many students, and that was like the perfect storm. So many people moving to the area. Dearborn schools were highly touted, so people wanted to be here. I don't know about the retention. I really didn't follow it that much, but it would stand to reason if there's an average number of kids that get held back. You know, there have, you know, this happens just through, you know, slow learning. In the case of East Dearborn, maybe English as a second language will keep some kids back. It was like a perfect storm, and it just grew and grew.
Yeah, they're just starting to talk about it, and there's no agenda item in the future specifically written for it, but if it comes to that point, they have a precedent where they have done that, but when I've spoke to Mustin, that is not the direction they want to go. They're going to try to take care of this as soon as possible. Ways to do that, you just have to really make sure you're sending the correct amount of students to each school. Maybe some can be moved between the three high schools. The smart bond that passed has the modifications and additions going into schools where they're going to make adjustments within the buildings that can help alleviate some of this. One other thing, they have a 5-year collegiate academy with the college here.
Wonderful program.
Right, and it's the first year, and they've only got about 67 students.
Okay.
But moving into the future, Whiston has said that if they can get more students into this program, then they will only be part-time at the high school and part-time at the college.
Right.
That takes some of the student body out. That can help alleviate some of the crowding in the hallways, because if you have a few hundred students every year joining into the Collegiate Academy, then there's that many students that are out of the building.
Right.
So when if the retention rate stays the same and there's still a lot of students, they're still manageable. You can still have the classrooms not being completely full.
Well, it certainly sounds like that Dearborn's got a good problem to try to manage. more students coming in. Just have to find a way to manage the numbers better than we have now.
Right. They're the third largest district number-wise in the state. Yeah. It's student numbers. They've got 19,400. Yes. They've got above that.
Whiston was saying, I think, is it Detroit, then Grand Rapids or something like that?
I believe Kalamazoo.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. What's interesting is, and I did read the the fact that I had read earlier, or I'd heard earlier, and that's I think her name is Amy Scholes.
Yep.
Amy Scholes, she's a board trustee. She said the retention rates that you're talking about, students are held back for failing grades. She said if we keep these retention rates in 4 years, we're going to be desperate for space. And sometimes it can sneak up on you. You can have, over the summer, X number of families move in, and they each have three kids, and that can happen. But it's really cool the way they're watching this. From where I sit, I don't even think about this stuff. You know, I always figure that there's going to be an average number of kids per classroom, and it's just always worked out that way for my life. Jay, however, and I hate to keep bringing up Jay, but we talk about his daughter, who's a Southfield elementary school teacher, and she goes through, she'll have 35 kids in her classroom, and half of them or more are special needs. I mean, that's a really tough battle. So I'm not saying Dearborn has it great, but like you said, it's a good problem to have, John, more people coming in, you know, into the learning institutions, but also the way they're watching it. Because if they're watching it this closely, then they're far more prepared than, you know, to be able to do something.
Going to their Board of Education meetings throughout the year, since I've started on the newspaper, I have really been impressed with the way they try to take care of problems before they start. They're not, from my estimation, they don't play much of the blame game. They don't, we didn't see this coming. They really try in every avenue to stay on top of things, to stay in communication, and to make to do things the best they can. It's really impressive to sit there and hear about what's going on at the schools. I mean, if they're bringing the music program back, they started two nights a week to have school gym night from six, or it's any grade level can go. But it's held at two of the middle schools. I believe it's Monday and Wednesday nights. Kids can come in, play basketball, play volleyball, get some exercise, get off the street, you know, give you something to do. They have a lot of cool ideas that they're going through.
I read the article about the bringing the music back. I actually read it from a different paper. Do you know anything about that?
A little bit. I haven't heard a whole lot about it yet.
I read from Katie Hattrick in Dearborn Press and Guide. She said that basically, from just to send it up, it's been a multi-year absence from all the schools. Now, most of the elementary, if not all, and the high schools have had this. It was the middle schools that suffered, and three of them in particular. It was Salina at Salina Intermediate, and then Stout Middle School and Woodworth Middle Schools. They're going to have their brand new music program starting in the next semester, second semester, which would be the winter semester, and all have both vocal and instrumental. That is a huge deal. We talked, Judy Fletcher was just on here. She's the director of the latest theatrical production here, Snow White. And I always thought of sports and music as being easily the two best teamwork and cooperative effort builders in my youth. If for no other reason than when you make a mistake, I play hockey, and when you made a mistake, yeah, your coach let you know, and your parents might to a degree, but your fellow teammates, that's who you're hearing it from. And there's something to be said about positive peer pressure in a constructive way. And it doesn't always come out that way. And I know, you know, whatever, and we've dealt with a lot with bullying lately. But the reality is, when you have all these guys on a team and everybody's playing their role, it's a really cool thing. It's the same thing in the music group or in a theatrical production or in a choir. So I'm ecstatic that both my kids sang and did went the theater route when they were in school. And it got to we belonged to something that was called the Crescendo Club. Parents started this, and you'd contribute money, and it was like a rainy day fund if the kids needed things. But I would have gladly paid for my kids to perform in this, whatever it was, to be able to take that if the school didn't have the money. It's so good to see this is coming back. Dearborn, citywide, all the schools, at least the public schools, will have all the vocal and instrumental music programs starting next semester. That's awesome. You did write about the, this was a while ago, and if this goes too far back, let me know, but the Dearborn Heights City Council, I saw you at the meeting, I believe, they discussed the effectiveness of the ordinance department. I would, based on what I've heard, it would be more likely the ineffectiveness. I mean, am I off there?
No, that is the complaint, that there's only a few ordinance officers, and if you get a lot of complaints, especially at the time of, with all the leaves falling trash pickup, these can really spur a lot of calls to an ordinance department.
Sure.
And I imagine they can get overwhelmed.
You're being so subtle. I work for the city of Dearborn Heights, so I have a lot more here. But if you talk to anybody, everybody will agree, look, we're doing the best we can with what we have. Did they talk, because I know in the past they've talked about adding ordinance officers at least on a part-time basis. Is that still in the works?
They're also talking about utilizing the volunteer police force for that too, if okay. they notice things while they're out.
Great idea.
Yeah, because you're already out on the street, sure. and they're volunteers. So if you notice things, you can write down the address, you can call the ordinance department. They are not trained to be ordinance officers. Now, whether that is something that can be changed in the future, they haven't discussed yet.
Okay. And doesn't it seem like a no-brainer to train them to do something like that? Where so they're out there getting paid anyway? Is that it?
The volunteers?
The volunteers. No, they're volunteers. They're right. not getting paid. Duh. Anyway, I'm thinking of the people in Dearborn. They will pay during the summer a nominal wage, usually young students, to kind of go up and down the streets to check the grass and how high it is. And again, Dearborn has a little bit more money.
Right.
Well, were you at the budget meeting?
The one just the other night, Tuesday?
Yeah, where they basically, there may have been a special session.
There was a special session Tuesday night. I was not able to make that.
But I think that was the one where they said, based on what we've budgeted and the money coming in, they actually are at a surplus. And Mayor Pletko's been saying that for a long time, and there's certain people, and some of them on council and other places, who have said, no, that's not possible.
Right.
The numbers look like that right now, though. You know what's funny about Mayor Pletko, and I really admire the man, he does hold a little bit back, and it's not a lack of transparency. He just doesn't want to say something that isn't a done deal.
Yeah.
I respect that. I mean, there's nothing worse than going, yeah, you know when I said there was a surplus? Well, no, there's not. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do, especially when you're an elected official. But after the fact, when you learn about, not what he was holding back again, but the things that he had working that weren't positive, well, first of all, I wish he would have said something, because, you know, that would have got you excited and you understand why he didn't. But usually these things come through. And I can't even give you an example now, Bob, and I'd love to. There were a couple of things that he'd been working on. Well, I think they're still working on a merger with the Garden City Fire Department. Because every time I see the mayor for his, regular mayor, Dan Pletko, shows, and he's like, yeah, we're still talking about it. I think they're looking at a similar model that is going in place right now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. There is the Dearborn and Melvindale Fire Departments merged. And the thought process isn't just that Melvindale's a smaller department, they have one station. It's the Melvindale station is physically located on Oakwood, and it is closer to reach some areas in Dearborn from that station than from any of the Dearborn stations. And likewise, Dearborn has fire departments closer to other areas of Melvindale that they can respond quicker than the Melvindale station. And the same can be said for Dearborn Heights and Garden City. So as they continue to look at this, they can look right over Dearborn and Melvindale and see a good example of how to merge fire departments and work collectively. It saves city's money, and you can get better services out of it.
Well, when I first heard about this was like literally the planning stages. So this would have been maybe a year and a half ago. And I sat down in Mayor Pletko's office and I said, is this feasible? Yet one of your fire departments is in fact on Telegraph, not anywhere near Garden City. He said, yeah, but it serves that area well. And our other fire department, which is on Beach Daily, is close proximity. And so are the Garden City fire department, or the fire department to Dearborn Heights. He said, if you looked at a grid, and somebody did this for him years ago, if you looked at a grid at the different communities in southeastern Michigan, and you looked at where the fire departments are placed, it's like they plan this. It's like they actually plan a cooperation between communities, because they're set up in such a way that it's not only feasible, it's logical. And one last thing, he said, except for one area where you had a fire department here and very close by on the same street, a fire department here, and he said, He couldn't figure out why, but then he realized there was a train track going right in the middle. So if there was a fire and there was a fire on one side and the train was going through, obviously it would have delays.
Sure.
So it made sense.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, again, this is something from my, you know, sitting here in this chair in front of a microphone, I don't really think about it. I don't plan these things, and so much has to go into this stuff, you know? I did find what I was looking for, Bob, and this is actually, it was written by your counterpart over at the Press and Guide, Renee Cizio, is that her name? This is great. This is actually dated today, so it went on the website today, but it was from the study session on Tuesday. She starts it out, so far, so good for the city budget. And you're laughing, and I'm laughing, because this has been, and I won't call it a circus, because that sounds really derogatory. It was, but it's been a back and forth. I remember it's an election year. Certain people, it is in their best interest to talk about how poorly the city is handling their budget, because that would help he or she in their, you know, quest for whatever. But according to this article by Renee Cizio, the city council reviewed the budget through October at a study session this past Tuesday. Of course, the fiscal year started July 1st, and the budget assumes about $40.7 million in revenue and only about $39.1 in expenses. So that's more than $1 million in that's over and above. And the city comptroller, Vince McAray, said that despite a few areas, the budget is on track. Here's a direct quote. He said, there are some expenses that are going to be over budget, especially the overtime in police and fire. But we're running so far ahead of the game in court revenues that it more than offsets that. I laugh at that, because the court revenues would be a direct relationship to how many tickets and things that are being written. Yet when the budget was planned or passed, other than I can only remember two people voting against it, Janet Badlow and I want to say Marge Horvath.
I believe it was Lisa Hicks Clayton.
Lisa Hicks Clayton, you're exactly right. And Tom Barry championed it, although he hated this fact. He wrote an editorial in the Press and Guide about the fact that part of the budget was based on revenue from writing tickets, basically court revenue. Janet Badlow was against it because her father was a magistrate, or she had ties to the court, and she flat out said that's an unpredictable thing, and it costs the city money sometimes when you write a ticket and the ticket can't collect the money from the ticket. So they went back and forth, and Tom Barry even wrote I wrote an article about it, but they used his editorial first of all, he's a city council member,
right.
And it was so direct, and he was basically said, how can you plan a future based on tickets that haven't been written? He said, this is the part that got me my attention. He said, people are going to be afraid of their policemen. As opposed to going to them for help, they're going to want to stay away from them, thinking they're going to be caught doing two over.
Right.
And get a ticket for it. So some logic there. I just think it's really interesting that here it is at this time where they can actually review some of the decisions they made. It's hard to tell when you're making these decisions. But here, you know, quite a bit of time has passed, and they're looking at it. And because of the court revenue, they are ahead of the game. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if that's a solid model to use to make your budget, but it was revenue that is actually coming in. So there you go. What else? What are some of the other things that about the election that caught you off guard?
The there are two newcomers into the Dearborn. We talked about Susan DeBaja getting the most votes to become council president.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say, but he had name recognition.
Well, that's the thing. He had name recognition, but I didn't know that he was going to come up all the way up to third, because he was... There was the one and the two were really close.
And he is Mike Cerini.
Mike Cerini. And his mother, Suzanne Cerini, has been on the council since 1990, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And there was so you had one and two being really close. Then three was a little way behind them. And then a gap until you get to the I'm not going to call them the back of the pack, because it was a field of 14 and seven advance. But he had a noticeable advantage to make it up to third.
I agree.
I was impressed by that.
And we had him here on the show and listened to him. He's very... articulate gentleman. I've known him personally for quite a while, because I used to be a waiter at one of the fine dining restaurants around here, and he and his wife used to come in fairly regularly, and I got to know them. And he's been at the car dealership where he's a sales manager for a long time. So it really didn't. I'm pretty comfortable when I knew that he would. You know, when people told me he might win. But you're right. That was quite a difference. Those top three, in and of themselves, surprised me, and then their relationship with the rest of the field was substantial. And then as far as some of the things that passed, I never really felt that the bond issue was in any danger, but I'll tell you what, some of the things, and John and I read an editorial on the air the week before the election, before that Tuesday, and a gentleman wrote a very well-written editorial in the Press and Guide?
It was in the Press and Guide.
And yes. It was about against the HFCC millage, at least the second one.
The additional mill.
The additional mill. And he said, you know, we shouldn't be bailing them out of their problems. And I mean, he was very, I can't say anything negative about it. And then in that same page, you know how the good editorial page will have a balanced page. And the balanced part of it was actually written by the people, the staff from the paper. You know, they didn't put a byline, but it was basically an endorsement. With the caveat that if this continues and the money is misspent, then we can look at that as something in the future. But right now, they need the money.
Yeah, the both of them, you got to remember in Dearborn Heights, you have four districts that vote for the Dearborn Public Schools and the Henry Ford Community College because of where they're located. Those, I figured, would be fairly close votes because of where they're at. But they passed, they had a really good majority. I mean, the Smart Bond had a good majority there, too, for Dearborn Public Schools. But in Dearborn, they all did good. I mean, it seemed that when you talk about the three renewing mills, that isn't as much of a surprise because a homeowner has to pay taxes to a community college regardless. Sure. It's in state law.
Right.
So if you don't give it to Henry Ford Community College, it's going to go to like Wayne County Community College, Schoolcraft, another school. So if you want to maintain the local control, then you approve the three mills to keep them the way they are. So that wasn't as much of a surprise. But the additional mill, they got a lot of good votes too. I think that people are impressed with the way the college has. I mean, when I came to the paper, we were looking at the school was facing a $16.6 million shortfall, and they're going to, all these drastic changes, and there have been changes made. I mean, staff have been moved around, or administrators have been laid off, contracts have been renegotiated, the lifelong learning program was closed. But if you look at all the moves that they've made, they're really setting themselves up for the future.
Did you meet Dr. Jensen?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I like him. He was one, when you mentioned Whiston with his quick wit, that was one of the first things I noticed about Dr. Jensen.
Yeah.
Was that he really has a good sense of humor.
Very unassuming, though. Yeah. Very, and but just, I mean, the things he's done, he's amazing. He's a published author. I think he has three books, and he's working on something. He was a pastor in Iowa, started his family based on that kind of solid ground, and went to school here in Michigan, at up near Grand Rapids, and then I think at Cornerstone, and then he got another degree, as he put it, across the pond. And he said, literally, there's like a body of water, and the school's over there. And you know, he's done leadership seminar. I mean, this guy is really, and I met his wife. We were at the Dearborn Farm and Artisans Market, and she was there as I don't know, she was helping out, you know, I mean, just a representative of the college or whatever. And just the nicest lady, just a great lady. And that brings me up to something I want to get in before we go. That is that the free winter market, which is an extension of the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market throughout the fall, but now it's the fall, winter, and spring, and that begins today at the Dearborn Ford Community and Performing Arts Center in Michigan Avenue. Admission and parking are free. That is going on right now, so if you hear this, get over there. It's 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. It'll be the third Sunday of each month from November through April, and that's at the Hubbard Ballroom, Ford Community Performing Arts Center. So get that. And of course, you're going to have holiday stuff coming up between now and the holidays. Also, the second annual Fall Pottery Boutique, that's here on campus in the Adjuray Auditorium McKenzie Fine Arts Building. Not the Auditorium, the McKenzie Fine Arts Building. That is going on till tomorrow. So you got to go there. We had Steve Glazer, appropriately named for ceramics. He was on last week, and that is going on. It was yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So please check that out. The first Full Circle Dance Company here at the college is celebrating the 25th anniversary, and they have auditions. The next date where you can audition is the 25th at 4 p.m. So, gentlemen, let's get our tutus. Actually, I know the lady who puts this on, Diane Mancinelli, and just an awesome person, and I wish her nothing but the best. And again, that's the 25th at 4 p.m. And I forgot to ask Judy Fletcher, but The Three Musketeers, the next production by our theater department, supposedly the auditions ended yesterday. I wonder if somebody didn't know about them, if they could still get an audition, but I didn't ask Judy. Anyway, Joanne is here for Highway 61. Gentlemen, thank you. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Again. Dennis, great time.
Thank I know. Enjoy your trip next week. You're going to be in Arizona.
Arizona.
Have fun. And Bob, we've been trying to do this for a while. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the offers. It's always great to speak to you and talk about local news.
And I'd really like if we can, regular basis sounds weird, but periodically if I can give you a call, and if at least if you're busy, we can at least get you on the phone to talk about it, because you are the person who wrote these things, the things that we talk about. We do talk about, you know, give you your byline on the air, but you're the one with the, I mean, you have even